What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Now let's kick this thing off.
Darius Dale is the founder and CEO of 42 Macro, the leading macro risk management advisor. In this conversation, we talk about what's going on in the macro economy, what's happening in the financial markets, how Darius is looking at various metrics, and also what you at home should be thinking about as you invest your capital. I really enjoyed this conversation with Darius, and I hope you do as well. Before we get into this episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by Exodus, the world's leading desktop, mobile, and hardware crypto wallet. They offer beautiful, user-friendly blockchain products that sync across all of your devices, making it easier to send, receive, and exchange over 150 or more crypto assets in one place. And with world-class customer service available to you 24/7, Exodus always has your back. But the fun doesn't stop with staking and trading. They recently launched a new NFT marketplace where you can buy and sell your favorite NFTs on the Solana network. By partnering with the popular NFT platform Magic Eden, they're offering the full Monty on verified collections, with more added every single day. Ready to check it out for yourself? Run, don't walk, over to exodus.com/pomp for your free download today. Again, if you want the world's leading desktop, mobile, and hardware crypto wallet, go to exodus.com/pomp today. Today's episode is sponsored by Abra. They're based in California, and they're backed by top VC firms. Abra is an all-in-one, simple, secure app that allows you to trade over 110 cryptocurrencies, get 0% interest loans using your crypto as collateral, and earn interest with up to 13% APY on stablecoins and 7.15% APY on Bitcoin. You can join nearly 2 million users by downloading Abra from the Google Play or Apple App Store. If you download the app today, you will get $15 in free crypto once you fund your account. You came, you invested, now conquer. Abra, conquer crypto. Go check it out today. This episode is brought to you by DeFi Technologies. DeFi Technologies represents what's next in the digital economy. They're providing simplified, trusted access to crypto, decentralized finance, and Web3 investment opportunities. Institutions and investors can gain diversified, secure, compliant, and easily tradable access to a diversified set of industry-leading equity products and protocols through a single stock purchase on a regulated exchange. DeFi Technologies is currently listed on the U.S. exchange at DEFTF stock ticker and the Canadian NEO exchange at DEFI. For more information or to subscribe to receive company updates and financial information, visit their website at defi.tech. I'm really excited about what these guys are doing. I've become an advisor to the business, and I highly suggest you go check them out. Go to their website at defi.tech today.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
Darius, what's up, man? How are you? Welcome back.
Oh my God, that was so entertaining. What's up, dude? How you been? I missed you.
I missed you too. How was your trip?
Dude, it was fantastic. Everyone needs to go to Paris and spend at least a week there before they die.
All right, let's jump in. Maybe the first place we could start is Jamie Dimon. I think it was yesterday or the day before. He came out and he said that he believes there's an economic hurricane on the horizon. And he basically said, look, nobody knows how big it'll be, how bad it'll be, or how long it'll last. We're going to be super conservative with our balance sheet. And I suggest, you know, basically everyone else follow the same thing. So it wasn't some like big prediction, but it definitely was like, hey, you guys should be paying attention to what's coming down the pipe. And we're going to be more conservative than we have in the past because we want to be able to withstand it. What's your general reaction from the CEO of one of the largest banks in the world talking like this so openly? Is that something that we should read into, or should we just expect them to do this?
So I'll start by saying the great starting point. I'll start by saying these guys are only as good as their models and their forecasters and the people who work for them that forecast the economy. I'm not making any representations about how good the JP Morgan economist team is. All I'm saying is you shouldn't take their words more than their words, their worth. It's just the guy who has a view on the world. We have a view on the world. But I do agree with this view on the world. We are heading to something that could look like a hurricane. Now, whether it's a category 2 or a category 5 is yet to be determined, but it's at least going to be a hurricane. And right now we are still on the beach in bright and sunny conditions. And so in our opinion, I think Jamie Dimon is appropriate. He's being a good steward of capital and trying to help investors prepare for that.
So you've got a chart that kind of leads into this. It's the financial conditions remain uncomfortably loose, which is very different story than what I think we're hearing in the kind of public narrative, right? Everyone's talking about quantitative tightening. They've started to conduct that. They're raising interest rates. There's been tough talk since like November of last year by the Federal Reserve. But this chart's telling a little bit of a different story. So explain kind of what this is showing us, and like why is the data showing us something different than maybe the public narrative?
Yeah, no, 100%, man. So this is a really important chart, and I want everyone to sort of take some time to kind of understand this. The red line just shows the Goldman Sachs Financial Conditions Index. Basically, how to interpret the chart is when it's low, it means financial conditions are loose, they're very accommodative. And when the index is high, is a high value, that means financial conditions are very tight. We've seen a decent tightening off the lows in the red line. But if you look at it on a historical basis, I mean, we're basically about as loose as we were at the peak of the dot-com bubble in terms of, so if you think about this in terms of the Fed's inflation fighting directive, they haven't really done anything to get growth to slow down enough to cause inflation to slow down, which tells you that, hey, as an investor here, we might have, seen some pretty significant declines off the highs in, crypto, Bitcoin, et cetera. But they could get a lot worse if the Fed is going to be successful in achieving its inflation objective.
So when you start to think about this, there's this whole idea of quantitative tightening. And really over the last, 13, 15 years, whatever you want to kind of count, there's been a very loose monetary policy. They at one point did try to conduct quantitative tightening. It didn't go so hot. They basically waved the white flag very quickly and went back to loose monetary policy. Explain to people in, kind of one or two sentences, like when you think of quantitative tightening, what should they be paying attention to? Or like, what are the important things to watch as they start to conduct this?
Oh, well, number one, what's the level of volatility, both implied and realized in financial markets? Because what happens when the Fed starts to shrink its balance sheet, we all understand that QE is positive for markets, but the reason it's positive for markets is mostly due to a substitution effect. We're taking safe securities out of the marketplace and leaving investors, whether they be asset managers, retail investors, ultimately through mutual funds, et cetera, with a bunch of cash that's burning a hole in their pocket and that needs to go to work if they're trying to generate a legitimate return, a real return. And so the quantitative tightening effectively works in reverse. The Fed is now creating a hole on the sort of the risk-free end of that spectrum. And now a lot of the money has to rush it from the further out on the risk curve to capitalize the U.S. government. And it's just, it's creating this sort of vacuum, this sucking effect on the further outs on the risk curve. So, when you said quantitative tightening, they tried it and then they waved the white flag. You're absolutely right. And the scary part about this particular time around is that not only are they going to do quantitative tightening into a global growth slowdown, a U.S. growth slowdown, but more importantly, they're going to try to get to a double from the previous pace of quantitative tightening. We've never seen this before. We've never seen the Fed hiking interest rates 50 bips at a time, doing $50 to $100 billion of quantitative tightening at a time as they will be in a few months. And so I think it's a real it's a science experiment, to say the least.
When you think of that, if they've never done this before, at the speed, severity, kind of simultaneous actions, the whole thing, should we throw out all historical analysis because this is a new environment and something that we haven't seen before? Or do you think history can still serve as a great guide as we evaluate what could happen in the future?
Yeah, no, 100%. You don't want to throw out historical analysis and analogs, but what you do want to understand is that everything, financial markets operate from a rate of change perspective, and particularly rate of change relative to expectations. And so, when you look at the world through that sort of, that very quantitative lens, rate of change, what's happening at the margin, what's changing at the margins, you then can bring in the historical analogs that help you identify, hey, the Fed might be shrinking its balance sheet with bigger numbers now, but on a relative basis to what the balance sheet was, this is, it's called a one sigma move lower or two sigma move lower. And so you can normalize things and help you create more scientific and more thoughtful analogs using historical data. And the reality is, when you're talking about the kind of growth slowdown that our model is projecting, at the same time you have a quantitative tightening episode, you're talking about anything on the order of 20 to 30% annualized declines in the S&P, 40 to 50% annualized declines in high beta stocks, and 60% annualized declines in something like Bitcoin. This is a really negative macro environment from a flows perspective. So all bets are off if you think about trying to buy the dip here, which a lot of investors have done.
So they continue to talk about very aggressive interest rate increases, quantitative tightening, all the stuff we're talking about. The market at one point was pricing in 10 rate hikes, 300 basis point interest rate. You've got some data that says we might not get there, which I think is becoming more and more obvious. Talk to us about this data, and then what do you think is going to happen?
So actually, pull up that chart, the second chart, USD, EUR, the other one, USD, EUR, and GBP/USD. So we're probably not going to get there, but we don't have to get there. The market just has to get there for them. And what I mean by this is these charts show the overnight index swap forwards for basically money market rates that are trying to price in the Fed funds rate on future time horizon. So you look at it on a 1 year forward basis, the market's at about somewhere around 3.2%, which is obviously significantly higher than what the current Fed funds rate expectation is. That number had peaked in early May and was really starting to flag, particularly as we started to get some leaking commentary out of Federal Reserve officials that they might actually consider a pause in September, with the expectation that obviously inflation would be starting to behave and get under control by then. Well, in terms of our analysis, we're not seeing anything in the inflation data that says it has to be under control by September. I mean, in the best case scenario, we have core PCE on a 3 month annualized basis at just shy of 3% in the month of September, data that'll be reported in late October. And so this concept that they're going to be able to pause in September really sort of has to lean on some very Pollyannish forecast for inflation that somehow magically just gets under control without the Fed ever taking financial conditions into restrictive territory, which in our opinion is very aggressive.
All right. And then you've got a third graph here that says the global downturn is not adequately priced in, which is crazy to think about given the asset price sell-off, et cetera. What is this telling us?
Yeah, no. So this chart is super important. The blue line is sort of a proxy for global growth. It's the world OECD composite leading index time series. The red line shows the S&P 500 high beta to low beta ratio. So this is the high beta stocks relative to low beta stocks. And historically, so in basically throughout our duration of our careers, we've had three of these sort of global growth slowdowns, let's call it 2010 to 2012, 2015, 16, and then obviously 2018 through 2020. These are non-recessionary slowdowns. I don't really count the lockdown as a recession. These are non-recessionary slowdowns. And this S&P 500 high beta, low beta ratio, again, high beta stocks relative to low beta stocks, declined 35 to 40% in each of these three instances. We're only down about, let's call it 18, 19% now, which suggests that even if we slow and do not go into recession, we're still only about halfway done in terms of the amount of pain that we're likely to experience in financial markets. And obviously, if we go into a recession, all bets are off. You look at the far left instance observation there, down 60%. I mean, I'm not anticipating a global financial crisis, but obviously, something that looks more like the 2000 to 2002 unwind of the dot-com bubble, which has been our core analog, is something that is very much on the tape in play.
Got it. And then when you start to think about these asset prices, obviously we continue to watch what I'm going to call a change in psychology among market participants. So investors waking up saying, hey, things are changing. Now we're starting to see founders of businesses or the executives of businesses doing the same thing. And it seems like there's maybe like a chain reaction. Public markets, obviously, they woke up in Q1 because they saw their stock prices falling. There was a ton of talk about it. Then we started to see like the growth stocks in the private market. They started to feel it because there were people pointing and saying, hey, well, your public comps, those multiples just compressed. You now have a different valuation, even if your business is still growing. You've got great cash, whatever. And now you're almost even seeing it trickle into like maybe like Series A, Series B private market stuff. Like, how do you think about the relationships across even just in equities, public and private markets, and like this like chain reaction of the psychological evolution that occurs?
Yeah, that's one of the best questions I've gotten all year. So Woo! Thank you for doing that. Yeah, I mean, you're one of the best. So, I mean, it's all good. There's a couple things I want to unpack there. Chain reaction is a very important phrase in that question, because I think what we miss as investors, we sort of think about things like recession or recovery, or in reality is it's not just this one monolithic thing. The economy is not this one monolithic thing. My threshold for what I can bear from a financial debt service perspective is very different than your threshold. And it's very different than the thresholds of people who are watching us live right now. And so the reality is this concept that, hey, look, when XYZ fund takes marks on this thing, they might not even be taking their marks at the same time as other funds take their marks. There's a legitimate chain reaction. And right now we're in a reflexive part of the cycle. We're in a reflexive down cycle so that when these things start to happen, they're going to send signals and triggers to other funds. So like, right. Like if you're a founder, you're done well in a company, you maybe raised some decent funds. You're probably not rushing out to buy dips in small private enterprises right now. So that segment of the financing economy really slows down. Obviously we've seen, I think, want to say it's been 170 to 200. I was reading this on Bloomberg this morning, deal of debt financing deals that have been just postponed this year to date. You know, so we're really starting to see a real slowdown and backup in financing activity in the economy. And that really matters. And the reason it really matters is because we're obviously a very indebted nation. With the exception of household debt, we're seeing a very aggressive rise in corporate credit and corporate debt outstanding and public debt outstanding. And it's a very financialized economy on top of that. I mean, 70% of all of our private non-financial sector credit in the U.S. economy is intermediated by non-bank financial participants, which means all of these interest rates, the rise in corporate borrowing costs, the rise in mortgage rates, the rise in real interest rates, all this stuff really matters in terms of slowing the rate of activity.
One of the things I keep coming back to is this idea that global debt to GDP is like 130% or it's like 350%. The U.S. Is 130%, give or take. Yeah. And so when you start to do this, like GDP growth's got to be double digits, right? To basically get on the other side of this. Is that possible? Like, is it possible to literally grow our way out of the global debt to GDP ratios?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the reason we grow is because we add new debt. Like if there was, yeah, sure. Actually, no, let me say that. There could be some massive, and this is what Cathie Wood is betting on, obviously, some massive change in technology that ushers in a wave of productivity that allows us to be substantially more productive with the limited resources that we have. And I would say limited and declining resources. I mean, you think about the kind of the aging of the baby boomer population and, you know, the size of that relative to the Gen Z population. We're going to have a reduction and our workforce over the long term, at least over the next kind of 10, 12 years or so. So that's going to be an issue in terms of trying to create GDP, right? We already ran out of land. We're running out of workers. So we got to find some technology that creates a lot more productivity and may or may not come. Certainly is not going to come, you know, in terms of the time horizon that we want to manage risk on as it relates to the downside in this market cycle.
Yeah. It's just fascinating to kind of think about the idea that like we have to keep playing this game. And so when you think about fiat currencies, you know, somebody like a Brent Johnson, who we recently had on, was talking about his milkshake theory. And we talked to him in 2020, talked to him again this year. And in recent weeks, he looks pretty smart. Dollar strengthened against, you know, relatively against other fiat currencies. Like, how do you see the currency markets playing out with all of the fiats on a relative basis?
You know, it's weird. I think we're at a very interesting point in the milkshake. And shout out to Brent because he's absolutely nailed that call. You know, what one thing I think is particularly unique in this set of circumstances is that during the COVID recovery, the U.S. economy was aggressively capitalized by the rest of the world, and as a function of that, we significantly outperformed the rest of the world. And not just as a function of that, we obviously had better vaccines, we had better reopening. Or at least, you know, places like Miami never even really shut down. I mean, you can go there in April 2020 and wouldn't know there was a pandemic, but I digress. But so we had a substantial outperformance in our economy. And as a function of that, investors all around the world were happy to just throw money in our markets, whether they be in Apple stock, you know, Google stock, you know, Amazon, Tesla, et cetera, so much so that, you know, we've seen about $6 to $7 trillion over the last couple of years enter the U.S. economy from a capital inflows perspective, if you look at the change in our net international investment position. Well, that's not to say that that all has to come out over the next 2 years, but it does seem to suggest that, hey, if the U.S. just comes back to Earth, and we're arguing in our research, we're not going to just go back to Earth, we're going to go to a below trend growth state by the end of this sort of projection period, or our next 12-month projection period. If we go to a below trend growth state, what's the reasoning for about being, you know, overly allocated, overweight U.S. assets, particularly U.S. risk assets relative to the rest of the world? And I would posit that that reason significantly goes away. And this is exactly what happened in the unwind of the tech bubble. It wasn't just that the Fed was too easy in response to the Asian financial crisis and long-term capital management that caused the NASDAQ to go up. It was the fact that the world was blowing up and every sovereign wealth fund and every asset allocator and every, you know, global asset manager was keen to dump money in our markets because we have a legitimate growth cycle and a significant outperformance and growth back then in the late 90s. And it was no different than it was in this COVID recovery period. And now that is starting to unwind at the margin. So to answer your question, it's a very long-winded answer. I apologize for this. I'm not so sure that the dollar is likely to continue heading higher, even though the Fed is going to continue to remove liquidity. Now, the dollar may, again, I'm not saying the dollar's peaked yet, but I think if you look at it on a 6 month and 9 month, 12 month forward basis, I could easily see a scenario where the NASDAQ's down, I don't know, 20 to 30% from here and the dollar's down 5, 10% versus its peer currencies.
So when you think about kind of what the Fed can do, do you have a thought process on the quantitative tightening? Like, is it September?
Yeah, they're going to do it until it breaks something. that's the only thought process.
But how long can that be?
I honestly think they'll be pivoting by their November 2nd meeting. That's kind of like my core.
Pivot in terms of let's pause or pivot in terms of reverse. Let's do interest rates. Let's go back to loose monetary policy, QE, et cetera.
No, I think so pausing in the context, there's really no pausing in quantitative. You either pausing by no longer shrinking or expanded balance sheet. That's what I mean by pivot. That would represent a real pivot. I don't think pausing in interest rates while still doing $100 billion or $90-some billion of QE, two Ts, who cares? we don't care about the interest rates anymore. They're already been priced in. Maybe you get another 25 to 35 basis points higher in the terminal Fed funds rate expectations if inflation over the next month or two surprises to the upside, which it very much can, by the way. We can go into all the wonky details on why I think that it might. But in terms of the pause and the pivot, I do believe that, hey, if the Fed gets to the November 2nd meeting, the world is sufficiently on fire from a capital markets perspective. Going back to that first chart, you've seen a more substantial tightening of financial conditions associated with the more significant growth slowdown that we have projected, particularly throughout the summer months. Then I do believe they'll be able to say, hey, I think $95 billion was too much. Let's just turn this off and look around and see where inflation settles out. If they pause by just saying, hey, we're going to go from $95 billion to $50 billion and we're not hiking interest rates anymore, then all bets are off. But I think once they pause, what constitute a pause in my book is they stop this entire program altogether. They don't have to go to QE, but they have to stop quantitative tightening, which they haven't even started, by the way. It starts next Wednesday.
any thoughts on whether they will get an interest rate cut? That's my contrarian. That's the only contrarian thought I think I have right now. Is that we may get an interest rate cut check, where everyone is thinking one thing and they basically just give us that one cut to say, hey, continue the party.
No, I see. This goes to the behavioral side of the trade, which is equally as important in times like these. So for all of you watching and listening, my favorite book, and I'm sure I get asked what books do I read and what not. Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky is arguably the most important book you'll ever read if you want to think about finance and economics. Certainly my favorite book, and you know, I highly recommend everyone read that book. In terms of understanding the behavioral side of this, we're human beings. And you have to realize that the Fed is human beings. Janet Yellen's a human being. Jay Powell's a human being. Joe Biden, a human being. These three human beings got together on Tuesday just to remind the American public that, hey, even though when you go to the grocery store, it keeps going up and up, and you go to the gas pump, it keeps going up and up, and you take your kids school shopping, and prices keep going up and up and up. You try to take your wife out for dinner, it keeps going up and up and up. Hey, we're going to do something about it. We messed up. My bad. We got transitory wrong. I mean, did you hear Yellen and Bullard yesterday? Ooh. I mean, Bullard basically came out and said, look, we're going to lose our credibility if we don't get going. And Yellen was like, yeah, you're right. I got the damn call wrong.
Do you think they got it wrong, or do you think that they knew what was going to happen and didn't say it?
No, they got it wrong. They definitely got it wrong, for sure.
That's what I think as well. There's a lot of people who were very mad yesterday when I said that we should respect the fact that a public official like Janet Yellen was willing to say on national television, I got it wrong. I thought that was fantastic, and that we should encourage more public officials. Doesn't excuse that they got it wrong. Doesn't mean that we should listen next time. But admitting that you're wrong in public, one, very hard for those people to do, and we should celebrate when they do it at a minimum, or at least encourage other people to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can count on one hand of all the investors that I know got the inflation call right. Certainly Jim Bianco, Julian Brigden. Maybe there's a couple others that I'm forgetting. I apologize if I'm forgetting you here. But I'll be the first person to say we got it wrong. Goldman Sachs got it wrong. PIMCO got it wrong. The Fed got it wrong. You know, all these institutions and research shops and very important Wall Street institutions and not so important Wall Street institutions sitting in my home here all got the inflation call wrong to varying degrees, right? So to be honest here, these are human beings with models and forecasts, And it's hard to model the kinds of shocks that we've experienced, particularly in this second half of the wave, the, you know, the kind of the Omicron dynamic shutting down the global economy again, and the supply chain disruptions that came out of that, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and the additional supply chain pressure on things like energy and food prices. That stuff's hard to model. It's easy to model the core inflation dynamics, that stuff. It's pretty simple, but the other stuff has been very difficult. But that's neither here nor there. What I'm really trying to say is this is an institution, the Federal Reserve, that is hell-bent on regaining credibility from getting a call wrong. They're a wounded animal, and right now they're fighting two battles. One, getting inflation back towards its target, and two, regaining the trust of the American people that they're, you know, millions are being harmed by these very aggressive price rises. So I would argue, Pomp, we're more likely to see them get incrementally hawkish relative to what's priced in the financial markets, particularly, you know, Fed fund futures, Eurodollar futures, OIS, et cetera, than they are to get incrementally dovish, at least over the next few months.
The other thing that I've seen recently is Arthur Hayes, former BitMEX CEO. He wrote a report and he said he essentially called the bottom. Right. Not explicitly, hey, this is the exact bottom, but he was like, look, I don't think Bitcoin will go below 27,000. I think ETH, he was talking about like 1700, 1800, somewhere in that range. And he used three things as his argument. One was there was a decoupling to some degree of crypto from the NASDAQ 100. Two was like the media is just yelling and screaming and being absurd and saying it's all dead and everyone in that industry is, you know, idiotic. And then the third thing he said was a relationship to past cycles. So, you know, the price in a new cycle doesn't go below the past all-time high. So Bitcoin at 20,000 in 2017, unlikely that we'd go below that. Mm-hmm. What's your take on like how Bitcoin and crypto as an industry will perform kind of moving forward, given all this macro kind of uncertainty?
Yeah, so right now, there's a couple things I'll say on that. So right now I've been very, you know, one thing that's sort of, you know, keeping me from saying this is going to be a sustained, there's several factors that have kept us from saying this will be a sustained bear market rally, at least in stocks, is the fact that we have not seen the kind of participation you would expect to see from the digital asset space. Obviously, Bitcoin's been chopping people up between 29 and 31,000 for weeks now. Ethereum, obviously, looking even worse from a technical standpoint. But just if you think about it from a broader macro market cycle perspective, I mean, a lot has to go right if you see another 20% decline in the S&P from here. Let's call it 20 to 30% decline in the NASDAQ from here for Bitcoin not to make new lows. I think it'll be very difficult. And again, don't forget, it's not just about where the fundamentals or the technicals are, because we know, I'm not great with on-chain analytics, but you know, we know that, you know, somewhere around 22,000 is a key level of support, 24,000 is a key level of support. Fundamentals don't matter when people need liquidity. And I can guarantee you, if growth slows worse, if the growth slowdown, by the way, this is our base case scenario. If the growth slowdown is worse than our base case scenario, we do go into a profit cycle recession and the Fed is, you know, shrinking its balance sheet at $95 billion a month and inflation is not behaving, people will demand liquidity. They will demand cash. And the only way they're going to be able to get it is by selling risk assets because, again, the deposits in the banking system are shrinking. The reverse repo uptake continues to go higher and the Fed wants it to go higher. This is a significant draining of liquidity from financial markets that is about to happen. And so in my opinion, I'm not sure you can price that in because, again, these are technical dynamics.
What's the thing that you're looking forward to or looking at that would surprise people the most right now?
Oh, and 100%. It'd be inflation surprising to the upside over the next couple of months.
Surprising to the upside.
Yeah, and the reason I say that, so right now, particularly if you look at core inflation dynamics, which is obviously what the Fed cares about most, core PCE, let's take core PCE. Right now, core PCE is running at about 4.9%. No, is it? Yeah, 5.9%. No, 4.9% on a year-over-year basis, 3.9% on a three-month annualized basis. And then you take it and look at what are the drivers, what are the leading indicators for core PCE? It's things like core services inflation, you know, core goods inflation, median CPI, sticky CPI, et cetera. So let's highlight two of those factors right now. One of those factors is core goods CPI, significant slowdown. We're only tracking at 0.8% on a three-month annualized inflation rate basis. Yeah, that's down from a year-over-year rate of change of 10%. Right now, core services inflation is actually accelerating. It's up 7.5% on a three-month annualized basis versus right around up 5 on a year-over-year basis. So what the biggest risk, I think, to financial markets right now is a incremental repricing higher of terminal Fed funds rate expectations and incremental hawkish rhetoric surrounding the pace, the timing, et cetera, of the quantitative tightening program. And how you get there is by services inflation alongside energy prices continuing to rise and food prices continuing to rise, taking that baton, wrestling that baton away from goods prices and causing the inflation basket to either flatten out or start to rise again from a core inflation standpoint. And to me, I think that we'd all be completely, you know, for lack of a better word, fucked if that occurs. And I think that's a more than 33% chance of occurring in the next couple of months. And no one's really positioned for that.
Yeah. It's, dude, we're going to be talking about this a long time. There's no right answer, right?
Inflation is sticky. This is what we learned in the 70s. This is what we learned in kind of in the early parts of 2000s and into 2008. Like, it's one, inflation is a lagging indicator. You can't just expect inflation to magically go down by itself without a slowdown in growth and a reduction in demand and the easing of supply and demand dynamics. But two, it's sticky.
Yeah.
You know, it permeates. It's sticky. You know, business A raises prices and wages go up. Then business B does the same thing. Then business C does what business B does. It's a process. And so we have a lot of tightening to do ahead of us for inflation to really start to behave in, I think, the manner the Fed wants, not just because of its mandate, but also because of its, you know, very human psychology that need to heal.
My friend, I appreciate you always coming here, dropping absolute facts on us. Where can we send people to find you on the internet or find out more about 42 Macro?
Absolutely, man. Thank you, man. So 42macro.com, come check us out. We definitely put out some world-class research. But if you can't afford it, just go check us out on Twitter at 42macro, D-Dale, D-D-A-L-E. Appreciate you, Pom.
All right, buddy. Sounds good. We'll see you next week. And I'm making my Paris recommendation list, and I'm going to call you.
I got some holiday. The folks at the Aquarium Club know me very well.
All right, buddy. I'll see you later.
See you, brother.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I really hope you guys enjoyed this one. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. And if you're looking to try to transition to get a new job in the Bitcoin or crypto industry, we've got you covered. Head over to pompscryptocourse.com. We've developed a curriculum with the top teams across the industry. It's a 3-week intensive training program with over 50 events packed into that 3-week time period. Go to pompscryptocourse.com to learn more, and I'll meet you guys for the next episode.